The proud man who trusts in himself has good reason not to attempt anything. The humble man is all the more courageous, because he places his whole trust in God, who rejoices to display his power in our weakness, and raise up his mercy on our misery. We may therefore humbly and devoutly presume to undertake all that is judged proper for our advancement by those who direct our souls. To think that we know what we do not know is complete folly. To desire to pass as knowing what we are well aware we don't know is inexcusable vanity. For my part, just as I would not parade knowledge even of what I actually know, so on the contrary, I would not pretend to be ignorant of it. When charity requires it, we must candidly and gladly share with our neighbor not only what is necessary for his instruction, but also what is useful for his consolation. Humility conceals and covers over virtues in order to preserve them, but it reveals them when charity so requires, in order that we may enlarge, increase, and perfect them. In this respect, humility imitates a certain tree found on the island of Tylos. At night it contracts and closes up its beautiful carnation blossoms, and only opens them again in the morning sun. Hence the natives of the country say that they sleep at night. In like manner, humility covers over and hides all our purely human virtues and perfections, and never displays them except for the sake of charity. Since charity is not a natural virtue, but a supernatural virtue, and not a moral, but a theological virtue, it is the true sum of all the virtues, and should have dominion over them. Hence we may conclude that acts of humility that are offensive to charity are certainly false. I don't want to play either the fool or the wise man, for if humility forbids me to play the genius, candor and sincerity forbid me to act the fool. Just as vanity is opposed to humility, so deception, exaggeration, and deceit are contrary to honesty and sincerity. If certain great servants of God have pretended to be fools in order to render themselves more wretched in the eyes of the world, we must admire, but not imitate them. They had their motives to act in this unusual fashion, and those motives were so special and extraordinary that no one should draw conclusions from them for himself. When David danced and leaped before the Ark of the Covenant with a vigor that ordinary decorum does not require, this was not because he wished to act foolishly. With all simplicity and without any exaggeration, he made use of such outward movements to express the extraordinary and excessive joy he felt within his heart. It is true that when Michael, his wife, reproached him for it as a foolish act, he was not sorry to see himself criticized. Continuing in a natural and genuine manifestation of joy, he testified that he was glad to be criticized for the sake of God. In consequence, I tell you that if people think you are wretched or foolish because of acts of true, genuine devotion, humility will cause you to rejoice at such fortunate criticism, for its cause is not in you, but in those who make it. 3. Humility causes us to love our own abjection. I now move on to tell you that in all things, and through all things, you should love your own abjection or wretchedness. In Latin, abjection signifies humility, and humility means abjection. Thus Our Lady says in her sacred canticle that because our Lord has regarded the humility of his handmaid, all generations shall call her blessed. She means that our Lord has graciously looked down on her abjection, nothingness, and lowliness in order to heap graces and favors upon her. However, there is a difference between the virtue of humility and abjection. For abjection is lowliness or baseness in us, although we are not aware of that fact, whereas humility is true knowledge and voluntary acknowledgement of our abjection. The chief point of such humility consists not only in willingly admitting our abject state, but in loving it and delighting in it. This must not be because of lack of courage and generosity, but in order to exalt God's majesty all the more, and to hold our neighbor in higher esteem than ourselves. I urge you to do this, and that you may understand me more clearly, I point out that among the evils we suffer, some are abject and others are honorable. Many men can easily adapt themselves to evils that bring honor with them, but hardly anyone can do so to those which are abject or lowly. You see a devout old hermit covered with rags and shivering with cold. Everyone honors his torn habit that he wears and sympathizes with his sufferings. If a poor tradesman, a poor gentleman is in the same condition, people laugh and scoff at them. Thus you see that their poverty is abject poverty. A monk meekly receives a sharp rebuke from his superior, or a child from his father, and everyone calls it an instance of mortification, obedience, and wisdom. If a man or lady suffers the same thing from someone, then even though it is accepted out of love for God, it is called cowardice and lack of spirit. Hence you see here another abject evil. One man has a cancer in his arm, and another on his face. The first has only the disease, while the other suffers contempt, disgrace, and abjection along with the disease. Hence I hold that we must not only love the disease, which is the duty of patience, but we must also embrace the abjection, and this is done by the virtue of humility. Moreover, there are virtues that are abject and virtues that are honorable. Patience, meekness, simplicity, and even humility itself are virtues that worldly people consider mean, abject, or horrible. On the other hand, they hold prudence, courage, and liberality in the highest esteem. There are also acts of one and the same virtue, some of which are despised and others held in honor. To give alms and to forgive injuries are both charitable acts, yet the first is held in honor by everyone, while the second is despised by the eyes of the world. A young gentleman who refuses to take part in the bad conduct of a bad group or to talk, play, dance, drink, or dress like the rest will be scorned and criticized by the others, and his modesty will be called fanaticism or extremism. To love this is to love our own abjection. Take abjection of another kind. We visit the sick, and if I am sent to the most miserable among them, it will be abjection for me in the eyes of the world, and for that reason I will love it. If I am sent to persons of quality, it is spiritual abjection, for there is not so much virtue or merit in it, and hence I will love this abjection. One man falls down in the public street, and in addition to the fall, incurs shame. We must love such abjection. There are even faults that involve no other ill except abjection. Humility does not require that we should deliberately commit such faults, but it does require that we should not disturb ourselves when we have committed them. Among them are certain kinds of folly, incivility, and accidents that we should avoid out of regard for good manners and discretion. But if they have been committed, we should endure the abjection we incur and willingly accept it so as to practice humility. I add further that if in passion or anger I have spoken any inappropriate words by which God or my neighbor may have been offended, I will sincerely repent and be sorry for the offense and make the best reparation I can. At the same time, I will accept the abjection and contempt it has brought upon me. If the one could be separated from the other, I would gladly cast away the sin and humbly keep the abjection. Although we love the abjection that follows an evil, we must not forget to correct by justice and lawful means the evil that caused it, especially when it is serious. If I should have some disagreeable infection in my face, I will try to have it cured, although not with an intention to forget the abjection I received from it. If I have done something that has not offended anyone, I will not apologize for it, since although it was an offense, yet it was not lasting. That being the case, I could not excuse it except with a view of ridding myself of the abjection, and humility does not permit this. However, if through an accident or folly I have offended or scandalized anyone, I will correct the offense by some true explanation, for evil is lasting, and charity obliges me to remove it. Moreover, it sometimes happens that charity requires us to remove the abjection for the good of a neighbor before whom our good name must be preserved. In such cases, although we remove the abjection from our neighbor's sight in order to prevent scandal, yet we must carefully enclose it in our heart for our own edification. If you wish to know which are the best kinds of abjection, I tell you plainly that the ones most profitable to our souls and the most acceptable to God are those that come to us accidentally or because of our state in life. The reason is that we have not chosen them ourselves, but have accepted them as sent by God, and His choice is always better than our own. If we were to choose any form of humiliation, we should prefer the greatest, and those most contrary to our inclinations are such, provided that they are in keeping with our vocations. To say it once and for all, our own choice and selection spoil or lessen almost all our virtues. Who will say with the great King, "I have chosen to be abject in the house of God, rather than to dwell in the tabernacles of sinners"? No one can say this, except Him who to exalt us lived and died in such a manner as to become the reproach of men and the outcast of the people. Many of the things I have told you may seem hard when you reflect on them, but believe me, they will be sweeter than sugar or honey when you put them to practice. 4. how we are to preserve our good name while practicing humility. Praise, honor, and glory are not given to men as rewards for a mere virtue, but for some outstanding virtue. By praise, we try to persuade others to esteem the excellence of a certain man. By honor, we testify that we ourselves esteem him. Glory, in my opinion, is only a kind of luster pertaining to a man's reputation and springing from the concurrence of many acts of praise and honor. Hence, honor and praise are like precious stones, and out of a collection of them, glory proceeds like an enamel. Humility does not permit us to have any opinion of our own excellence, or right to be preferred before others, and therefore it cannot allow us to seek after praise, honor, and glory, which are things due only to excellence. Yet humility agrees with the counsel of the wise man who warns us to take care of our good name, because to esteem our good name is not to esteem an excellence, but only ordinary honesty and integrity of life. Humility does not forbid us to acknowledge this within ourselves or to desire a reputation for it. It is true that humility would despise a good name if charity had no need for it, but because good name is one of the bases of human society, and without it we are not only useless but harmful to the public by reason of the scandal it would provoke, charity requires and humility agrees that we should desire to have a good name carefully preserve it. Moreover, just as leaves growing on a tree are not themselves of much value but serve important purposes, not only to beautify the tree but also to preserve its tender young fruit, so with a good reputation. Of itself, it is not very desirable, but it is very useful not only for the enhancement of our life, but also for preservation of virtue, especially of virtues which are as yet only weak and tender. The duty of preserving our reputation, and of being actually such as we are thought to be, urges a generous spirit to go forward with a strong and agreeable impulse. Let us preserve our virtues, because they are acceptable to God, the great and sovereign object of all our actions. But just as those who want to preserve fruit are not satisfied merely with covering them over with sugar, but put them into vessels that can keep them, so too, although love of God is the principal preservative of our virtues, we can also employ our good name as very proper and useful for that purpose. We must not be too ardent, precise, and demanding in regard to preserving our good name. Men who are overly tender and sensitive on this point are like persons who take medicine for slight discomforts. Although they think they are preserving their health, they actually destroy it. In like manner, those who try too carefully to maintain their reputation lose it entirely. By such sensitivity, they become captious, quarrelsome, and unbearable, and thus provoke the malice of detractors. Generally speaking, to ignore and despise an injury or calumny is a far more effectual remedy than resentment, fighting, and revenge. Contempt for injuries causes them to vanish, whereas if we become angry, we seem to admit them. Crocodiles harm only those who are afraid of them, and detraction hurts only those who are angry by it. Excessive fear of losing our good name reveals great distrust in its foundation, which is really a good life. Towns that have wooden bridges over great rivers are afraid that they will be swept away by every little rise of water, but those with stone bridges fear only extraordinary floods. In like manner, those with souls solidly grounded on Christian virtue usually despise the floods let loose by harmful tongues, while those who know that they are weak are upset by every report. In a word, a man who is too anxious to keep his reputation loses it. The person who tries to win reputation with those whose vices have made them truly infamous and dishonorable deserves to lose honor. Reputation is like a sign pointing to where virtue dwells, and therefore this virtue must be preferred in all things and through all things. Hence, if anyone calls you a hypocrite because you are devout, or a coward because you have pardoned some injury, laugh at him. Although such judgments are passed on us by foolish and stupid people, we must not forsake the path of virtue even if we suffer loss of reputation. We must prefer the fruit before the leaves, that is, interior spiritual graces above all external goods. It is legitimate to be jealous of our reputation, but not to be idolatrous of it. Also, just as we must not offend the eyes of good men, so also we must try not to please the eyes of the wicked. A beard is an ornament on a man's face, and hair is such on a woman's head. If a man's beard is plucked from his face, or a woman's hair from her head, it will hardly grow on again. But if it is only cut off or even shaved close, it will soon come back and grow stronger and thicker than ever. So also if our reputation is cut off or even shaved away by the tongues of detractors, David says that they are like sharp razors. We must not disturb ourselves. it will grow out again, not only as beautiful as before, but even much stronger. If our vices, base deeds, and evil life ruin our reputation, it will hardly return again, since it has been pulled out by the roots. The root of a good name is virtue and goodness. As long as they remain in us, it can always regain the honor due to it. If some vain way of life, idle habit, foolish love, or custom of keeping improper company should injure our reputation, we must give them up. Our good name is of more value than any such empty pleasures. But if because of an exercise of piety, advancement in devotion, or progress toward heaven men grumble, murmur, and speak ill of us, let us leave them to bay at the moon. If at times they can cast aspersions on our good name, and thus cut and shave off the hair and beard of our reputation, it will quickly grow out again. The razor of detraction will be as useful toward our honor as the pruning knife is to the vine, which makes it abound and multiply in fruit. Let us always keep our eyes fixed on Jesus Christ crucified, and go forward in His service with confidence and sincerity, but with prudence and discretion. He will protect our reputation. If He permits it to be taken away from us, it will either be to give us a better one, or to make us profit by holy humility, of which a single ounce is preferable to 1,000 pounds of honor. If we are condemned unjustly, let us calmly oppose truth with calumny. If calumny continues, let us continue to humble ourselves. By surrendering our reputation together with our soul into God's hands, we safeguard it in the best way possible. Let us serve God by evil report and good report, after the example of St. Paul, so that we may say with David, "Because for your sake, O Lord, I have borne reproach. Shame has covered my face. Nevertheless, I accept from this certain crimes so horrid and infamous that no man should put up with being falsely charged with them, if he can justly acquit himself of it. I also accept certain persons on whose reputation the edification of many others depends. According to the opinion of theologians, in such cases we must quietly seek reparation of the wrong received.